Hello, everyone. Welcome to our listeners in the Big Apple from across the U.S. and around the world. I'm Jeff Goodman, and you've tuned into Rediscovering New York. Professionally, I'm a real estate broker with Halsted Real Estate, and I love New York. Rediscovering New York is a weekly program about the history, texture, and current vibe of our amazing cities. On most shows, like tonight's, we focus on an individual New York neighborhood, exploring its history and its current energy. What makes that particular New York neighborhood special? And we do it through interviews with historians, local business owners, nonprofit organizations, preservationists, local musicians, and even artists. Sometimes we host a show about an interesting and vital color of the city that's not focused on one particular neighborhood. In prior episodes, we've covered things like a history of U.S. presidents who had some kind of history in New York. We've looked at the history of the women's suffrage movement in the city. We've talked about immigrants who've come here. We've had some episodes during Stonewall 50 about the city's LGBT history. We've explored the history of bicycles and cycling. They've been in New York for 200 years. And we've had shows on the history of punk and opera in New York. They were separate shows, by the way. We kept them separate. In the future, we may journey to some of the city's parks, or the subway, or some of our grander train stations, where the city in the age of a specific social or political movement. After the broadcast, each show is available on podcast. You can hear us on iTunes, Spotify, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and there are other services, some of which I don't even know about, but they're out there. Tonight, we're journeying to a very special place. It's one of the quintessential New York neighborhoods, and it's also, in a lot of ways, the story of America, the story of the United States, a place where many different people have come, lived, thrived, and have moved on to continue their lives in other parts of this great country in the American dream. My first guest is Morris Vogel. Morris J. Vogel is the president of New York's Lower East Side Tenement Museum. He was president from 2008 through 2017, and he's resumed that role in 2019 to guide the museum through a leadership transition. He trained as an American social and urban historian at Brandeis University and the University of Chicago, where he got his PhD. He joined the faculty of Temple University in Philadelphia in 1973, where he was promoted to professor in 1985. Morris served in a number of leadership roles within Temple's College of Liberal Arts, acting as dean of the college from 1999 through 2003. He subsequently directed the Rockefeller Foundation's Creativity and Culture Program before coming to the museum. That's the Tenement Museum. Vogel is the author or editor of six books in American social and cultural history, including The Invention of the Modern Hospital and Cultural Connections. He founded and directed the National Endowment for the Humanities-funded Mid-Atlantic Regional Center for the Humanities. While a Pennsylvanian, which he's no longer, Vogel served on the Commonwealth's Historic Preservation Board. He and his wife, Ruth, a clinical psychologist, live in East Midtown. Their son, Kenneth, covers American politics for the New York Times. I'm sure he's been in the news a lot lately in the past couple of weeks. And their son, Jonathan, is professor of economics at UCLA. Morris Vogel, a hearty welcome to Rediscovering New York.
Thanks, Jeff, and thanks for having me on.
You're not originally from our fair city, are you?
Not at all. No, I grew up in rural Connecticut. We've lived over the years in suburban Boston, Chicago, Philadelphia, where we raised our kids, Tokyo, and in New York for the last 15 years.
What is it that first brought you and Ruth to New York?
I can't keep a job, as that resume points out. And I was a professor of history, dean of a liberal arts college, Temple. I joke, and I hope it's taken that way, that I was a lot smarter than most of my faculty colleagues in that it took me only 20 years to discover it was not all that hard to convince 19-year-olds I was brilliant, and I was looking forward to something more challenging and rewarding to do, and the Rockefeller Foundation knocked on the door, and easy to say yes.
How long after you came to the city did you become president of the Tenement Museum, which is officially known as the Lower East Side Tenement Museum?
About 5 years.
Well, speaking of the Lower East Side, I'm going to do a little bit of pre-sort of history. Like a good part of New York, we know that there were local Lenape people who lived in the area before the Dutch settled here. And the Lower East Side was a part of the island before it was urbanized that had a lot of Dutch farms that were here. Fast forwarding to around the time of the American Revolution, who was James De Lancey?
The Lanceys were major landowners. They sided with the British during the war. They left because they were on the wrong side. Revolutions sometimes do that. Division Street, which marks nearly the southern boundary of the Lower East Side, was so named because it divided the lands of the De Lancey family from the lands of Henry Rutgers. Rutgers chose the right side in the revolution. He stayed. He was a bit of a philanthropist, gave some money to a college in New Jersey that renamed itself in his honor. Delancey's name stays with us on in Delancey Street. The American revolutionaries didn't change all the names. Why else would we be New York City and New York State? We're named after the Duke of York. He was on the wrong side in the revolution. And Orchard Street, where the museum is located, at the corner of Orchard and Delancey. Orchard Street was where the Delancey family orchards were.
Wow. I wonder why they didn't change the name from Delancey. Rutgers also has a street named after him
right
on the Lower East Side.
Well, they didn't change the name of New York. They didn't change British names.
Ah, okay. A little bit of a colorful history. New York has had lots of red light districts. Today I found out that there was one that was down in part of the Lower East Side that was near something called Corlier's Hook. And a bit of etymological history, I was also, maybe it's not surprising to find out that the term hookers came from the people, the sex workers who actually worked in the Lower East Side in New York. Leave it to New York to come up with some important words in our dictionary. But post-revolution, as the city was growing, before that, Delancey actually planned some development, but it never came to pass because his land was confiscated by the legislature because he was a loyalist. When did the Lower East Side begin to become more urban? And when would it have begun to have been broken up into streets, and when would houses resembling an urban landscape have begun to grow?
Well, it's the growth of the city, the growth of its trade, the growth of its population that bursts the city from its seams. Don't forget, Wall Street was originally the northern boundary of New York. It was the north. It was the wall protecting the city from the wilderness. It's as the port grows in the early 19th century that you get the settlement of in the kind of houses that, not quite what we know today, but 2- and 3-story wooden homes that you'll get on the current street pattern below Houston Street. That's early 19th century. I do a walking tour of the Lower East Side for the Tenement Museum. I do it once a week. The museum offers it maybe 15 or 20 times a week. And Orchard itself, just north of Grand, there's a brick structure that dates from the 1810s that until recently was 2 stories tall. Since then, the owners have added a 3rd story. It's brick because in the 1810s, the city passed a brick ordinance that required new buildings to be somewhat more fireproof than the wooden shanties that marked the area before then. So you get individual family homes in the early 19th century, and then as you get mass immigration in the 1840s and 50s from Germany and from Ireland, those homes are subdivided and subdivided. If you're a landlord and there's pressure on the land, you're in real estate. What do you do? The first thing you do is you say, well, this is a 2-story house. I can put two families in it and charge full rent for each floor.
Or more.
Or I can put a partition between the front and back of each floor and put in 4 families. And what's wrong with the basement? I have 5 families in there. Once you are confident as a property owner that this population growth is not a temporary phenomena, you then have the confidence to get the capital, tear down the structure and put up a 5 or 6 story building. A lot of the Lower East Side below Houston is composed of so-called pre-law tenements, brick buildings deliberately built for multifamily occupancy, 5 and 6 stories that went up in the 1860s and 1870s. The Tenement Museum at 97 Orchard is the oldest surviving pre-law tenement in that part of the city. The law changes in 1879 and will require what we now call dumbbell tenements, or these tenement buildings with air shafts and really blind air shafts with no light in them, no air in them. That's after 1879. And while there's some of that below Houston, there's much more of that above Houston.
Those are known as old law tenements,
right?
Because then there was another law. So you have pre-law tenements, old law tenements, and new law tenements.
And then you have new law tenements after 1901 outlaw the air shaft for new construction, that require that every room actually open to a real source of light and air, and that horror of all horrors, if you're a real estate owner, that you need indoor plumbing. That's the 1901 law, and it will require 2 toilets for every 4 families.
So even before 1901, online before, I saw a picture of a privy. It's a polite word for an outhouse.
Right.
And it looked like it was right on the street.
In the backyards, right. Oh. And so an old law tenement took up a city lot, is 25 by 100 for the most part. And the old law tenements took up the front 90 feet. And you didn't really have a lot of, there was a backyard, but the backyard is where the privies were, and you did the washing.
So the first real big wave of immigrants came beginning in the 1840s with German and Irish immigrants.
Right.
What was the neighborhood like when they lived there?
Our part of the neighborhood was German. It was German-speaking. It was one of the largest German-speaking communities in the world. It didn't have a significant Irish population. That tended to be down on Five Points and where the courthouses are today, and literally the other side of Chinatown. And that's because the Irish had the misfortune, when it came to life on the Lower East Side, or Klein Deutschland, Little Germany as it was called, the Irish spoke English, which was not the language of daily life on the Lower East Side.
And I remember reading somewhere that the third largest German-speaking population in the world was in Manhattan, the first being Vienna and then second Berlin around the time that...
That may be so. People claim lots of things for New York. It's like the old Rheingold commercials, you know, in New York, where there are more Poles than in Poland, more Greeks than in Greece, and so on.
Well, I did know one thing about there were more Jews living in New York than in the State of Israel, but when I was growing up in the 60s. But I want to ask you a question. The elevated train started going up in the city late in the 1870s.
Right.
And then we have the Second Avenue L.
Which came down Allen Street.
How did that impact the development of the Lower East Side?
Enormously. So this was a German-speaking community. By the 1870s, and the L goes in 1878, and actually reaches up the Far East Side by 1880. When the L comes in, at that moment, the German population has been here for a generation or so. Many of them have made it. There's something about American life that allows many immigrants, not all, and not everybody who lives here. Many people are excluded from the American dream by virtue of race. But Germans ride a bit of an escalator, and that allows them to have the means to get out of what by the 1870s is absolutely the worst imaginable, the most crowded neighborhood in New York. And they can take the L, not to move, but to move out, because the journey to work, the daily journey that you take to your job down in the, say, in the port of New York and in the downtown area, you can commute back and forth on the L. So the neighborhood begins to empty out in the 1870s, actually even before the L goes in, but the L really accentuates that movement. So you get empty housing, cheap housing, housing suited for poor people at the very moment that in Russia, the Russian Empire goes through a bit of a set of issues of its own, the assassination of Tsar Alexander II, the Russian state, the Tsarist state is under threat, and the way to secure that the Russian state tries to secure its hold on power is to give the Russian population an enemy, someone to vent their anger at, so it's not the state. In the old days, Russians often accomplished this by attacking Ukraine, but at that moment, Ukraine was actually part of Russia, so they couldn't act out that way. So instead, the Russian state turn the Russian population against an internal Jewish population. Jews responded by leaving by the hundreds of thousands, ultimately by the millions. They come, they go to Western Europe, they go to Britain. More than any other place, they come to the United States. They go across the United States. More than any other place, they come to New York. And within New York, more than any other place, they come to the Lower East Side, because that's where you have cheap housing for poor people. You've got a neighborhood in which they can make themselves understood. Unlike the Irish, they speak Yiddish. Yiddish is a dialect of German. It makes it possible for them to find their way on a daily basis, because not every German leaves at the same moment. And on top of that, of the Germans who had come in the 1820s, 30s, and especially after the failure of the 1848 revolution in Germany, a significant number of Germans, perhaps 1 in 10, were Jews. So they found on the Lower East Side a community of co-religionists, people who could presumably be available to them and in a supportive way. They found synagogues. They found the texture of Jewish life that in some ways was recognizable and of which they could take advantage.
Hmm. Well, we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to continue our conversation with Morris Vogel of the Lower East Side Tenement Museum. We'll be back in a minute.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network. Are you stuck in a rut? Negative thoughts, feelings, and conversations got you down? Hi, I'm Noreen Sumter, the Potentiator. Tune in every Tuesday at 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time and listen for new ideas on my show, Beyond Potential, Live Life Your Way, on talkradio.nyc.
Are you a conscious co-creator? Are you on a quest to raise your vibration and your consciousness? I'm Sam Liebowitz, your conscious consultant, and on my show, The Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity, we will touch upon all these topics and more. Listen live at our new time on Thursdays at 12 noon Eastern Time. That's The Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity, Thursdays, 12 noon on talkradio.nyc.
Talking Alternative Radio, 24 hours a day.
We're back, and you're back to Rediscovering New York. I'm Jeff Goodman. And today we are visiting the Lower East Side. Our first guest is Morris Vogel, the president of the Lower East Side Tenement Museum. Morris, let's talk about the museum for a minute. It's one of the younger museums in the city, isn't it?
It is. Anita Jacobson and Ruth Abram founded the museum in 1988. They found this disused tenement house that had been condemned as unfit for human occupancy in 1935. The city had passed a multiple occupancy dwellings act that required structures to be sort of fireproof. They had to have stairs made of either iron or stone or brick. And this building, because the pre-law tenement, had a wooden stairway, so it could no longer be occupied. It was sealed up. And it was, in effect, it was a time machine. And they saw that you could use this building to interpret the multiple waves of immigration to the United States and to the Lower East Side, the hundreds of thousands of people who followed their dreams to this country and the city, who built lives, who established families, earned livings, raised children, who really built the communities that we think of as American, through their stories, through the stories of individual families who lived in these spaces, one could get a sense of how people from many nations became Americans, and even more, how Americans became a people. And so that's a legacy that we've been living up to, and one that we've actually been able to extend into the recent period of the late 20th century. We acquired another tenement building, an old law tenement that stayed active through the end of the 20th century. And in that building, we've been able to add to our stories of German and Irish and Italian and Polish and Lithuanian and Russian families. We've been able to add families of Holocaust survivors. We've been able to add the stories of Puerto Rican migrants and the story of Chinese immigrants who came after the immigration law changed in 1965. Both of our buildings are recognized by Congress as a National Historic Site. The tenement, the 1863 building, is a National Historic Landmark. It's equal in American law in terms of its historic significance to, say, Ellis Island or Independence Hall in Philadelphia.
Well, sadly, the mission of the museum actually would be well regarded by many people in the United States who, some of whom seem to have forgotten where we came from and what a lot of our roots are. And the Lower East Side is certainly a testament to that. I remember reading somewhere that the block that the Tenement Museum is on was once the most densely populated block in the entire world.
I think the museum says that on its website. I'm not prepared to defend that.
Okay. Well, you're a historian, so you need primary sources for that.
What I can say is that by 1900, the 2 square miles of the Lower East Side had a population of well over 700,000 people. To give you a sense of contrast, compare and contrast, today Manhattan has a population double that, about 1.5 million people, in 27 or 28 square miles, in 15 times the area.
And that's with high rises.
And we live in 30 and 40 story buildings with indoor plumbing. And these folks lived in 5 and 6 story buildings without plumbing in 1900.
What was, getting back to the Jewish immigration to the Lower East Side around the end of the 19th century and early 20th century, they built up a network of social services and religious, social, and cultural organizations. What were some of those that immigrants would be able to find that would better the lives that they had in what otherwise would be a crowded, squalid place?
There are a couple of different sorts of these organizations. Some the immigrants build themselves, Landsmannschaften, hometown societies, a place where people from a village in Bohemia or Lithuania would they might buy a building, they might rent some rooms. It was a social fraternal organization. It also doubled as a place that provided medical care. It was a place for your daughter to meet someone from the same village, so she would meet someone, say, from Italy. It was a place for people to worship. I did a program for Central Synagogue here in New York a couple weeks ago, a walking tour for the for the 180th anniversary of this Upper East Side Reform congregation that originated in a Bohemian Landsmannschaft on the Lower East Side. Today, you go around the Lower East Side and you see all these Chinese hometown societies. They're remarkably the same. So you've got building, you've got structured communal organizations that come from within. You've also got those that come from above. So German Jews who become more comfortably settled, move to the Upper East Side and the Upper West Side, will create settlement houses. The Educational Alliance, the Grand Street Settlement, Henry Street Settlement, and even secular settlement, non-Jewish settlement houses like University Settlement.
These, for our listeners who don't know what settlement houses were or still are, what are settlement houses?
A settlement house is a place where people who are literally more fortunate, who don't live in the neighborhood, who have the means and the desire to improve the lives of some of the poorest of their fellow, not even fellow Americans yet, but their fellow human beings. It's a place you literally create a structure. People from outside the neighborhood live there. They settle there. And they provide classes and things like how to rear your children, how to cook an American meal. Don't use spices. You know, go for white bread. That sort of thing. They help Americanize don't use pickles. It'll make you too excited. That sort of things. They try to bleach out the customs that people bring with them. Also, art classes in English language, all ways of helping people adapt to a new environment. And the third large group of entities that are changing the lives of immigrants are public institutions, the public schools, most conspicuously. Julia Richman, who is an uptown German Jew, a member of Central Synagogue, becomes the first district, the first Jewish and the first female district superintendent in the New York public schools. She's charged with responsibility for the Lower East Side. She knows that these schools can change the lives of the students in those communities. By the way, she instructs the staffs in those schools to, if they encounter a student speaking a home language like Italian or Jewish, which would be the major languages during her period, Yiddish in her period, she instructs them to wash the student's mouths out with soap.
Wow, wouldn't quite be acceptable today.
These were
different
tough
times,
people,
right? Well, I remember times when growing up, one or more of my siblings would occasionally get their mouths washed out with soap. I think that happened to me once.
Not for
speaking Yiddish. We have another couple of minutes left. Who were some of the more recent immigrants who moved into the Lower East Side, especially after the Second World War?
Well, after the Lower East Side, the economy is very heavily garment industry. And the garment industry takes root there not because there are waterfalls or whatnot, because of that. In the middle of the 19th century, you get the rise of mass production and, more importantly, mass consumption. You get department stores that drive demand the same way the internet does now. You get standardized sizing. You get the mechanical sewing machine. And at that moment, you get a mass immigration of Jews and Italians. Jewish and Italian men sew. Polish men don't sew unless they're Jewish. Englishmen don't sew unless they're Italian. You get a garment industry then that produces more than half the women's clothing manufactured for sale in the United States by 1900 in home sweatshops in the Lower East Side. The 1924 immigration law essentially ends the immigration of Jews and Italians. That labor force dies out over the 1930s and 1940s. It ages out of the workplace. By the 1940s, you need workers, and the garment industry then recruits from Puerto Rico because Puerto Rican men sew. And this becomes, the Lower East Side becomes the largest Puerto Rican community on the mainland. Following the 1965 law, which ends Chinese exclusion, it ends the racial basis of immigration to the United States. It's the
signed by President Johnson at the foot of the Statue of Liberty in 1965.
Absolutely. Yeah. You get a piece of legislation that opens the United States up to what it had been in terms of welcoming immigrants before 1924. Well, Chinese men sow. There's a small Chinese community, a small Chinatown that predates 1882 and the Chinese exclusion law. It's on the Lower East Side. When you open the United States to Chinese immigration, you'll get an immigration that's attracted to the Lower East Side, and New York then becomes the Lower East Side becomes the hub of the largest Chinese community outside of Asia. Hmm. So that's the other part of a major part of the story of the Lower East Side.
And of course, beginning in the 1980s, you have more artists and more young people moving into the neighborhood, and beginning in 2000, more of a renaissance, but development as far as better housing and transformation into more of what the neighborhood is today. Morris, we're out of time.
I would add that whoever comes is following, whoever comes to New York, whoever comes to the Lower East Side is following their dreams.
Yes, in New York especially. And how true that the Lower East Side embodies the American dream and the dream of this great nation. Sadly, it's lost on some people now, but hopefully we will not lose sight of our better angels there. Morris, thank you. Our first guest has been Morris Vogel, who's the president of the Lower East Side Tenement Museum. By the way, what's the website address for the Tenement Museum?
It probably is www.tenement.org.
Okay, great. Thanks. Well, we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to have our second guest, who is one of those people who has brought something new to the Lower East Side, a business owner who appeals to people's culinary tastes, but also who has helped evolve the neighborhood as well. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network at www.talkingalternative.com. Now, broadcasting 24 hours a day.
Talking Alternative.
Do you run or are ready to open your own business? Hi, I'm Jeremiah Fox. I've been operating and opening small business for the last 25 years, and I'm the host of the new show, The Entrepreneurial Web. Tune in every Friday at noon Eastern Time for insights and stories on the nuances of running small business right here on Fridays at noon, talkradio.nyc.
Do you love or are you intrigued about New York City and its neighborhoods? I'm Jeff Goodman, host of Rediscovering New York, a weekly show that showcases New York's history and its extraordinary neighborhoods. Every Tuesday live at 7 p.m., we focus on a particular neighborhood and explore its history, its vibe, its feel, and its energy. Tune in live every Tuesday at 7 p.m. on talkradio.nyc.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network. Are you stuck in a rut? Negative thoughts, feelings, and conversations got you down? Hi, I'm Noreen Sumter, the Potentiator. Tune in every Tuesday at 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time and listen for new ideas on my show, Beyond Potential, Live Life Your Way, on talkradio.nyc.
Talking Alternative Radio, 24 hours a day.
Back. Support for Rediscovering New York comes from our sponsors, the Mark Maimon team, mortgage strategist at Freedom Mortgage. For assistance in any kind of residential mortgage, Mark and his team can be reached at 646-330-4735. And support also comes from the law offices of Thomas Siaka, specializing in wills, estate planning, probate, and inheritance litigation. Tom and his staff can be reached at 212-495-0317. Our show is about New York, especially its neighborhoods and the myriad textures of this amazing city. There's another great show on the air about New York, and specifically about the business of real estate. Good Morning New York Real Estate with Vince Rocco, my friend and colleague at Halsted. Vince's show airs live on Tuesday mornings at 9 a.m. on voiceamerica.com and also on podcast. You can like the show on Facebook, Rediscovering New York with Jeff Goodman, and you can follow me on Instagram and Twitter. My handles there are Jeff Goodman NYC. If you have comments or questions, or if you'd like to get on our mailing list, please email me, jeff@rediscoveringnewyork.nyc. One other note before we get to our second guest, even though Rediscovering New York is not a show about the real estate business, when I'm not on the air, I am indeed a real estate agent in this amazing city. I help my clients buy, sell, lease, and rent property. If you or someone you care about is considering a move into, out of, or within New York, I would love to help you all with those real estate needs. You can reach me at my team at 646-306-4761. My next guest is Neil Kleinberg. Neil is the founder and co-owner of the Clinton Street Baking Company on the Lower East Side, but we also share a little bit of personal history, small world. Neil and I actually went to the same high school, went to Midwood High School, around the same time. But getting to more information about Neil, he's the co-owner of the Clinton Street Baking Company and also Community Food and Juice on Morningside Heights. Neil raised himself in a crazy kitchen in Flatbush. That's in Brooklyn, by the way, among four kids, two parents, 16 neighborhood cousins, and six aunts and uncles. Sounds like a classic Brooklyn family. At 10 years old, he became a one-boy culinary wonder who'd do anything to avoid his mother's famous dish, chicken in a pot, which he says is the only dish that was in her repertoire. Neil opened his first restaurant, Simon's, in Lincoln Center, at just 22 years old, and in 1997 reopened the legendary seafood restaurant Lundy's in his native Brooklyn. Another close fact, Lundy's was a five-minute walk from my home growing up. Neil has appeared on Martha Stewart Living, The Today Show, Good Day New York, The Cooking Channel's United Tastes of America, Real Food on PBS, and has thrown it down with Food Network's Bobby Flay. He's the co-author of Lundy's, Reminiscences and Recipes, and of course, the Clinton Street Baking Company Cookbook. Neil serves on the advisory board of his alma mater, New York City College of Technology. His Clinton Street Baking Company has global outposts in Japan, Singapore, Bangkok, and Dubai, as well as at the Time Out Market in Dumbo, Brooklyn. Neil Kleinberg, welcome to Rediscovering New York.
Hey, Jeff. How are you?
So we know that you're from New York. You're from Brooklyn and Flatbush originally.
Yep.
Well, we talked about, mentioned a small world it can be. We went to the same high school, and we just found out that we had a couple of the same teachers. What other neighborhoods have you lived in the city?
Oh, I lived on the Upper West Side. I lived in Hell's Kitchen. I lived up in Morningside Heights. I've lived, I lived on the Upper West Side in a few locations, 91st in Amsterdam, 73rd between Central Park West and Columbus, and basically all around, and a lot of time in Brooklyn.
Well, like me, you're kind of the classic native New Yorker with roots in Brooklyn and having spent a lot of time there. You decided that you would go into food service and food creation pretty young in your life. What was, aside from not wanting to have your mother's signature dish?
I always knew that I wanted to cook from when I was 10 years old. And as we were talking earlier off the air, my father was a postal clerk on the Lower East Side, and his love for food and produce and his expertise in shopping, I guess, inspired me to want to cook. And when I was 10 and 12 and 14 in the 70s in Brooklyn, it wasn't fashionable. There weren't culinary institutes. There wasn't people wondered about me. What's wrong with this kid? He wants to be a chef. And through a cousin of mine, I found, who was studying criminal justice at John Jay, I found New York City Tech for Hotel and Restaurant Management. And it was a city school. And my father said, that's where you'll go, because the tuition was cheap. And you wouldn't know me from Midwood from high school anyway, because I was a truant and I barely got out of high school. But once I found my love, culinary arts and baking and cooking and restaurant management, I found my calling and my love. And of course, I graduated with honors and loved the business and loved cooking and never looked back and cooked in New York restaurants my whole entire life.
Wow, that's great. What was your first business in restaurants?
Well, you know, I had prep cook jobs, baker assistant jobs, line cook jobs, sous chef jobs. And at 22, during the time I was in college, and at 22, my best friend from culinary school said, let's open a restaurant. And I didn't have enough experience then, but we opened a place in Lincoln Center called Simon's, named after my late friend John Simon. Not the theater critic John Simon, but the restaurant critic John Simon. And we were a smash hit, and we were two young punks out of culinary school, 22 and 24.
And in the 80s.
In the 80s, and we lit the Upper West Side on fire. So, you know, we were just, we were cooking great food. We had a tiny little spot, and of course, it went like that. Mm.
What brought you to Lundy's? And for those people who don't know Lundy's, Lundy's was this old line restaurant in Sheepshead Bay. I think that opened up in the 1920s, maybe.
Absolutely.
And they would, a huge restaurant, they would serve so many people, and then it shut down, I think in the late 70s or the early 80s, but then it had another incarnation.
Right.
And you were its executive chef.
I was. You know, it's funny what you wish for. Be careful what you wish for, because when I was in cooking school, my parents couldn't afford Lundy's in the 60s and 70s. That was like high end for them. It was famous for their seafood and their raw bar and their lobster shore dinners and all of this great stuff that we really couldn't afford. But I aspired to become a chef there. And 25 years later, it had a resurgence. And I interviewed for the executive chef and became the executive chef. And that was really the craziest, hardest, most pressurized job I've ever had in my life. And it was phenomenal. It was gigantic. The food was great. We basically recreated Lundy's from the 40s and 50s into, you know, in 1995. And that lasted a couple of years only, and I couldn't take it anymore. Had to get out, and I came back to the city. And that's when I had an opportunity to come back to the Lower East Side.
Hmm. Well, another bit of serendipity, I worked across the street from Lundy's, not at the same time that Neil was a chef there. But I will say that we were talking before going on the air, and I remember an amazing seafood cream dish I had at Lundy's and found out that Neil had created it. What was the genesis of you and your partner opening the Clinton Street Baking Company in the Lower East Side? How did you decide to do that?
Well, it was a very funny story that I worked with a cook at the Plaza Hotel for a few years. And he called me out of the blue and he said, Neil, you have to buy my sister's restaurant. And I said to this guy, Tommy, I said, I haven't heard from you in 12 years or so. Why are you calling me? He said, because my sister opened a restaurant on the Lower East Side and it's going downhill and I want you to buy it from her and I'll sell it to you cheap. So I asked my wife, who wasn't my wife then. She lived in the West Village, had a beautiful studio in the West Village. We walked all the way from the West Village to the Lower East Side. We walked in and I looked at her and I said, what do you think? And she said, don't do it.
And I said, so how did you come about doing it?
We weren't married. And I said, I said, F you, I'm doing it. So we did it. I did it with a partner and I started Clinton Street Baking Company on the Lower East Side in 2001 before 9/11. And we weren't married yet, Dee Dee and I. And I just started it very slowly, baking my recipes that I've collected over the years for our muffins, our scones, our cookies, our biscuits. The biscuits actually that I created for Lundy's, I brought to the Lower East Side. And our biscuits now are world famous. You know, we do them loaded with raspberry jam and butter, and they're amazing. We serve them with a lot of different dishes at Clinton Street. So a couple of years pass, and I'm developing this small business on Clinton Street where there was no one and very few regulars and no foot traffic, and the Lower East Side was nothing.
No, I remember I was on the board of a nonprofit that was based at a school around the corner on Suffolk Street. And I wouldn't call Clinton Street desolate, but in terms of the kind of business that you run, it was pretty desolate.
No, there was only one restaurant, and it was 71 Clinton, started by Wiley Dufresne. And we were the new kids on the block coming in, but we were doing classic American food with a twist. Well, a couple of years into it, my partner and I, we decided that we were going to split, and my wife bought him out. So Dee Dee and I became husband and wife, partners in the business, partners in Clinton Street.
Which happened first, the marriage or the partners in the business?
The marriage happened, and right after that, I wasn't getting along with my partner, and I said to him, either I'm out or you're out. And he said, okay, I'm out. And Dee Dee bought him out, and we became partners. And thanks to her, and thanks to her vision and her confidence in my cooking and my restaurant experience, that we've been able to build a beautiful business and something we're really proud of.
And branches all over the place. Dubai, and amazing, Singapore.
I don't even know how it happened. That's all Dee Dee's doing. Her negotiating skills, her food skills, her taste buds, all of that. Together, collectively, we've been able to expand and carry our brand all around.
Oh, we're going to take a short break, Neil, and when we come back, we're going to talk about your experiences in the Lower East Side and how you've seen the neighborhood evolve since you opened Clinton Street Baking Company. We'll be back in a minute.
Talking Alternative Radio, 24 hours a day.
I'm the aptly named host of Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio. Big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. Fundraising, board relations, social media. My guests and I cover everything that small and mid-sized shops struggle with. If you have big dreams and a small budget, you have a home at Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio. Fridays, 1 to 2 Eastern at talkingalternative.com.
Are you a conscious co-creator? Are you on a quest to raise your vibration and your consciousness? I'm Sam Liebowitz, your conscious consultant, and on my show, The Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity, we will touch upon all these topics and more. Listen live at our new time on Thursdays at 12 noon Eastern Time. That's The Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity, Thursdays, 12 noon on talkradio.nyc.
TalkingAlternative.com.
We're back to Rediscovering New York. We are back at Rediscovering New York, and you're back as well. My second guest on the show is Neil Kleinberg. Neil is a partner in the Clinton Street Baking Company, one of the pioneers of the revitalization of the Lower East Side as a place that people like to go and hang out and eat and drink. You've been in the Lower East Side now for 18 years, Neil. How have you seen the neighborhood change since you opened your business there?
When you're in something every single day for 18 years and you go there every day from Upper West Side and come to work, it's hard to see change. It's hard to see like your kids growing up and changing year to year. But I guess it was more gritty, a little grungier, a little spookier. It was a little rough around the edges 18 years ago. It wasn't like you feel... like you're walking through Soho or you're walking through Tribeca or something like that. It was sketchy. And unless you knew people, neighborhood people or artists on the block or other, you know, merchants, you know, it was like you didn't feel 100% safe. Mm. But, you know, 18 years later, it feels totally different and it feels built up. I wouldn't say cleaner necessarily, but built up and a little swankier and a little more polished and just people moving into the neighborhood. Years ago, I used to see a lot of people moving in and out of our building where we are. And a lot of trucks, like NYU students, moving in and out of their apartments and stuff. And I haven't seen that as much over the last, I'd say, 5 or 8 years.
Well, if the housing, I mean, I remember the Lower East Side in the East Village in the 80s, and the housing wasn't great quality. And if there were students living in some of these buildings and the apartments were not really very nice, you know, as soon as they had any kind of income, they would move out and move along.
Right.
And maybe they were still rent regulated and weren't in such great condition. You know, one of the interesting things, too, Orchard Street north of Delancey still has a lot of old line discount businesses. But
right.
Orchard Street south of Delancey, when you opened your shop, was pretty abandoned. It was pretty, I mean, it was not abandoned, but it was just not nice at all. There was nothing there. Now,
nothing there.
You almost wouldn't recognize it, the restaurants and the bars.
It's true.
One thing, too, and a little bit of sort of revitalization, there are, but transformation and moving. There's a punk-oriented store called I Need More. Jimmy Webb, I think, is his name. He worked at a store near St. Mark's Place and decided to bring, you know, that whole 80s punk genre to Orchard Street. And there were a couple of interesting businesses across the street. I was very pleased to visit there not too long ago.
Well, you know, a lot of our old our regular customers from the early days are, you know, were musicians and artists. And I don't know if there's a show on cable called Lower East Side Biography. Penny Arcade hosts it. And she's like an iconic Lower East Side figure. And she's been a regular of ours for years. And she interviews people like Blondie and the punk rock, you know, The Clash and all the CBGB's people. And we've had a lot of those people as our regulars and our friends on the block since we started. And of course, years later, they complained, Neil, I can never get in. I used to love your place when there was four people in there. And I would say to a neighbor, a friend, yeah, well, if no one came, then I wouldn't be here anymore. So it was kind of that thing, you know, regulars and people from the Lower East Side were pissed off that we got popular and busy and that they couldn't get a seat immediately.
Hmm. Well, it happens to your benefit. Describe the vibe of the Lower East Side right now, the neighborhood that is now. What do you like about it?
It's just a really great eclectic mix of everyone. I mean, Latinos and religious Jews and, you know, young people and students and a lot of tourists. And it is really an incredible mix. And I know it because I see it and I'm on that block all the time, parking my car or going to the bank or, you know, running errands or going to the Essex Street Market or, you know, grabbing a hot dog at Katz's or whatever. I am in that. And so I know the eclectic mix of people that come to Clinton Street and come to the Lower East Side.
Neil, do you know if most of your customers are people who live in the neighborhood, or are most of your customers now people who just come through and are there because it's a place of attraction and then they find the Clinton Street Baking Company?
I'd say it's a mix. I'd say it's 50% tourism and 50%, you know, people coming to Clinton Street because they want our pancakes or they want to eat our food and they heard about it or they know it on Instagram or they know it through social media.
And the way you describe your pancakes is mouthwatering in the elevator coming up. I was thinking, why didn't you bring any? They sound delicious.
They don't travel well. You have to come and eat them there as soon as they get off the griddle, and then you'll experience heaven. It's a mix. It's a mix of people from all over the world. And I have to say, you know, our neighbors across the street are Dominican, and our the cafe that these young Italian guys opened a few years ago are cool. And they have a lot of bohemian tastes and people coming in for green juice and things like that. And then you have like the old school neighborhood people coming in to Clinton Street. So it is a mix.
Is there anything that surprises you about the Lower East Side now that you've owned and operated a business there for 18 years? A little bit of a trick question, I know.
It surprises me that my dad, if he were alive today, would absolutely be blown away that I wound up on the Lower East Side where his career was for 30 years. And he schlepped up and down those streets and knew every single rabbi and every single person that lived on the Lower East Side. And that surprises me that he would absolutely never believe it in a million years.
Well, I was about a year ago, I was walking up Allen Street with one of my best and oldest friends, Hillary Joseph. And we were thinking, could you imagine what our grandparents and great-grandparents would believe? They wouldn't recognize the place.
Unbelievable.
What advice as a business person would you have for someone who is looking to open up a business in the Lower East Side specifically?
Well, it's funny. It's happened to me before. A couple of my chef mentees and baking mentees, people that have worked for me over the years, people that I've worked with in other venues and other restaurants, have come to me and say, Chef, I want to open on the Lower East Side. And I tell them the first thing, find a side street, find a building that's not very prevalent, find something small, and find something cheap.
Lower rent, right?
Get in on the bottom so that you have a chance to make it in the business without having to pay so much rent and so much real estate tax and all of that. And if you start small and grow with it, you'll be able to succeed if you have a good product.
Well, thank you. Our guest, our second guest, has been Neil Kleinberg, founder and co-owner of the Clinton Street Baking Shop, Clinton Street Baking Company, which you can find on Clinton Street on the Lower East Side.
Between
Neil, thank you so much for joining us on Rediscovering New York.
My pleasure.
If you have comments or questions about the show, you can email me, jeff@rediscoveringnewyork.nyc. You can like us on Facebook, and you can follow me on Instagram and Twitter. That's Jeff Goodman, NYC. And I'd like to thank our sponsors, the Mark Myman team at Freedom Mortgage and the law offices of Tom Siaka. One more thing before we sign off. I'm Jeff Goodman, a real estate agent at Halsted in New York City. And whether you're selling, buying, leasing, or renting, my team and I are dedicated to our clients and come to our work with passion. And we bring to our clients the best expertise in New York City real estate. You can reach us at 646-306-4761. Our producer is Ralph Storier. Our engineer is Sam Leibowitz. Our special consultant is David Griffin of Landmark Branding. Stay tuned at 8 p.m. right here on talkradio.nyc for Beyond Potential. Live life your way with Noreen Sumter. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
Talking Alternative Radio, 24 hours a day.
Do you run or are ready to open your own business? Hi, I'm Jeremiah Fox. I've been operating and opening small business for the last 25 years, and I'm the host of the new show, The Entrepreneurial Web. Tune in every Friday at noon Eastern Time for insights and stories on the nuances of running small business right here on Fridays at noon, talkradio.nyc.
I'm the aptly named host of Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio, big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. Fundraising, board relations, social media. My guests and I cover everything that small and mid-sized shops struggle with. If you have big dreams and a small budget, you have a home at Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio. Fridays, 1 to 2 Eastern at talkingalternative.com.
Hey, all you crazy listeners. Looking to boost your business? Why not advertise on Talking Alternative with very reasonable rates? Interested? Simply email at info@talkingalternative.com.
Are you a conscious co-creator? Are you on a quest to raise your vibration and your consciousness? I'm Sam Leibowitz, your conscious consultant, and on my show, The Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity, we will touch upon all these topics and more. Listen live at our new time on Thursdays at 12 noon Eastern Time. That's The Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity, Thursdays, 12 noon on talkradio.nyc.
We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network at www.talkingalternative.com. Now, broadcasting 24 hours a day.
Talking Alternative.
Do you love or are you intrigued about New York City and its neighborhoods? I'm Jeff Goodman, host of Rediscovering New York, a weekly show that showcases New York's history and its extraordinary neighborhoods. Every Tuesday live at 7 p.m., we focus on a particular neighborhood and explore its history, its vibe, its feel, and its energy. Tune in live every Tuesday at 7 p.m. on talkradio.nyc.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network.